Hello, and welcome to another episode of my podcast, Stepping Up. My name is Sue Reed, and every week I provide a platform for people to tell their story of how they have faced and overcome a challenge in their life. Here is today's story. My guest today is James. James is husband to Danny and also father to Hunter and Leumbra. James describes himself as a biologist, an aspiring writer, a dreamer, and a practitioner of gratitude. James' story today is about how in June 2017, he started noticing some odd symptoms in his body. This was tingling in his fingers and toes, and later became numbness. And that really started a year-long medical journey to try and find out what the problem was. And eventually in 2018, James was diagnosed with having a very rare blood disorder, which is known as POEMS, P-O-E-M-S, which is basically an acronym for the multiple systems it can affect. So 2017, you started, welcome to the show, James, by the way.
Oh, thank
lovely
you,
to have you here. I'm just so interested to get started, really. So in 2017, you noticed some odd symptoms. So when did you start thinking, this isn't right, it shouldn't be happening?
Well, it was interesting because when it first started, it was very subtle. It was sometimes, you know, sometimes when you sleep, you wake up and there's that tingling that kind of lingers in your hands and whatnot from the way you're sleeping, and you're thinking, oh, I just slept on it wrong or something like that, or maybe I was sitting too long or something like that. And it was really kind of, it wasn't lingering. It was something that would just be noticeable and then it would pass.
Yeah.
And then over time, over the course of 6 to 8 weeks, the tingling kind of persisted. And while it was starting to become noticeable, my coworkers actually were the ones who made me aware of it, that as I was, when they would see me walking, they were noticing that I was starting to show signs of a foot drop. I was walking at a slightly odd gait because I was lifting my legs a little higher to compensate for the fact that my ankles weren't lifting my foot fully anymore. And then what really got my attention was one day I came home from work and went to, we have a series of steps leading up to our front door to come into our house. And I went to step on that first step and my ankle just completely gave out and I fell in our driveway and had to crawl into our house to get inside.
And you'd completely lost the feeling then in your feet, had you?
It was kind of like that. It was basically a numbness. It was that I realized then that there was just no sensation in there. And some things you kind of take for granted. Like I said, this took over the course of several weeks for this to happen, months really. And so I had been compensating for those subtle losses over that time. And then that day, it just was, I don't know if it was just a combination of a stressful day and everything else that kind of built up on it, that it was really became noticeable or something else. But whatever it was that day, my ankle just completely gave out on me. Now, after I got in the house and was able to rest a little bit, I was able to get back up and start walking around again. But it made me much more acutely aware that there was an issue at that point.
So it's almost like your body was sending you little signals saying, hey, there's something wrong here. And you were ignoring them and compensating, like you said. And then all of a sudden it said, look, come on, we're going to sort this out. And it's just, I'm going to just collapse.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah. So what happened then? Did you go to a doctor?
Yeah, after the fall, I got into the house, but it was later in the day. So I called my doctors early the next morning and let them know that I had had a fall, and they scheduled me this. It was on a Friday when I called them, and they scheduled me for a Monday to come in and get some blood work done and a CT scan, and started setting up all of the testing for situations like that, looking for neurological issues and things like that. So yeah, that was the beginning of a very long kind of month and a half long testing procedures for me to even get an initial diagnosis of what they thought it might be, going between regular doctors, getting MRIs, seeing a neurologist and have them doing the muscle and nerve testing and everything. And it wasn't until the neurologist did what is, it's called an EMG. It's basically where they put needles into your muscles and send electrical currents through it to measure the communication speed along the nerve within the muscle. And they found out that there was no nerve conductivity below the ankle anymore. It was as if there was just no electrical impulses going through my feet at that point.
Kind of like your feet weren't speaking to your brain sort of thing. There was the message had got cut off somewhere. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he sent me directly from his office to the emergency room at the hospital where they took me in and diagnosed me. At that time, they diagnosed me with something that was called CIDP, chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, and which is a neurological disorder where it's an autoimmune disorder where the immune system starts attacking the nerves in the body and it starts to destroy the myelin sheath, which is what is the protective coating around the nerves.
Right.
And so I was in the hospital for a week receiving daily immunoglobulin infusions, which is normal plasma cells from healthy people being put in through an IV for 5 days in a row.
Right. Which must have been quite frustrating.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable. I already had issues with needles to begin with. I was never comfortable with needles. And here I was getting multiple needles at a time. And at this point too, my circulatory system was also having a lot of stressors on it going on. And I already had an issue with rolling veins where my veins are just they're very deep and they're very hard to, they're not always staying in place. So not only was I getting needles, which I disliked a lot, I was getting multiple needles for them to actually get the IVs and things into the veins properly to begin with. So it was very uncomfortable, something that should normally only take one or two attempts to get in. We're taking three and four and sometimes more. And then they couldn't get it in one arm. They'd have to move to another arm and then move down to from the elbow down to the forearm, to the hand or wherever they could manage.
There's you ending up like a pincushion then.
Basically, the beginning of it, I was very much a pincushion.
And then after that, did they then decide actually that's not what it is? It's something else.
Well, the tricky thing about POEMS, and one of the reasons why a lot of people aren't diagnosed with it immediately, is because the symptoms, the main symptoms that show themselves are the polyneuropathy. So it is the tingling and numbness in the extremities, like the fingers and toes. And initially it will respond to the same treatments as CIDP. Mm-hmm. So those initial treatments actually worked really well. The immunoglobulin transfusions stopped the progression of the numbness so that it was no longer felt like it was creeping up my body toward the central part of my body. It just stayed at the periphery. And so because that worked, they began a series of treatments for the recovery of that condition, which usually involves a high dose steroid treatment over a long period of time to help initiate and speed up nerve regrowth, and also for helping sustain the muscles during that time so that while there is no neural connection, you don't go through the atrophy of the muscle and everything from not having that stimulus going to it all the time. And they also continue doing monthly immunoglobulin infusions or transfusions to prevent your immune system from sliding back into that mode. So for about 8 months, I was on that treatment. About 3 months in, my neurologist took me off the steroid treatment because while it was keeping my muscles strong, there didn't seem to be any sign of the nerves regrowing or reconnecting. There wasn't any progression, which is they were happy about, but the steroid itself was not seeming to have any effect. And long-term steroid use can be detrimental to the body. Yeah. So he not seeing any positive effects of it, he decided to stop that, which ultimately I'm grateful for, as later on down the road, we found out that keeping that up may have actually been more detrimental to me in the long run.
Right. Okay.
So that went on for about 8 months, and my neurologist here where we live, he had reached a point where he wasn't sure what was going on at that point. And he started sending referrals out to some of the more well-known institutions around here in the US for dealing with neurological disorder, more specialized neurological disorders.
Yeah. Cause that's the problem with rare conditions, isn't it? That a lot of doctors have never come across it, don't really know, you know, how to diagnose it. So you do need somebody that actually specializes in that particular area. And then suddenly you've got a diagnosis straight away.
Yeah. Yeah. He had tried to send me to multiple places. And then we had a friend who worked at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland.
Right.
And they helped me get into their system there a little bit quicker, as it had been, I guess, about 2 months, and we still hadn't heard back from some of the other places that they had tried to contact or get me a referral to. And even with Johns Hopkins, it still took another month for me to actually be able to get an appointment time in. And when I went there, the neurologist that I was seeing there specialized in peripheral neuropathies. So he specialized in things like ALS, MS, and things like that.
Right.
And so I spent an hour and a half sitting there talking to him from beginning to end, walking him through the entire journey and everything like that. And he wasn't certain, but he realized there were certain key tests that, while everything had been done the way that you normally would proceed with this kind of thing, the testing had stopped when I responded well to the CIDP treatment with the transfusions and stuff like that. So he decided that there were several more tests that they needed to run and look at to make sure that the CIDP diagnosis was fully accurate at that point. And that is when some of the blood tests and things that they had done at that time showed that I had POEMS.
Right. Okay. So then you had a diagnosis. So, which I think that's always a good thing, to know exactly what's wrong, because then you can move forward with that knowledge and, you know how your life is going to evolve. So all of this must have put quite a strain both on you and on your family.
Yeah, it was extremely stressful in the beginning, especially back in the early part of 2017, when we didn't know what we were dealing with. Even when we got the CIDP diagnosis, we still weren't fully understanding what we were dealing with. And while the treatments and everything were going, it was uncomfortable in a lot of ways, because like my girls were seeing me in a physically depleted kind of state all the time. I was always tired. I had a lot of difficulty moving and things like that. But we had to ask them to kind of step up a little bit more with things. There was a lot of uncertainty about how we were going to move forward and how we were going to deal with everything. And it wasn't just the physical stress of it, but it was the emotional stress of everything that was going on, and trying to constantly deal with these, you know, it was doctor's appointments after doctor's appointments and spending time in hospitals and things like that. We had a lot of friends who stepped up and helped out along the way and everything like that. But about halfway through all of it, you know, my wife and I made a conscious choice that we were going to reframe how we viewed this. You know, we were trying to understand, we were saying, you know, we could focus on, you know, okay, this is happening. We have, you know, we got to, you know, all the things that you tend to do with, we have to we have to do this, we have to do that. We don't know what's coming, what, you know, and the panic that kind of rises up when you don't know what's going on. And we made the conscious choice to not do that. Mm. You know, my wife has been, she's been really big into personal development and growth for a long time. And I've always been somewhat resistant to it. I have a difficult time a lot of times with a lot of the philosophies and a lot of the ideas that they bring about and the approach to it. Being a scientist, I have a very kind of
very logical.
I have a very structured and logical way I need to approach things. And some of these things I was like, what is that? That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
You do sound like my husband, I must admit. He's exactly the same. What are you on about now?
Yeah. And it's funny that it's I think men in general tend to be more that way. I don't know if it's a product of just the way kind of the masculine identity is thought of and is kind of almost societally ingrained that this is the way it is, or if it is actual.
Yeah.
And also there is some hardwiring within your body that does this. I mean, being a biologist, I understand that aspect of it pretty well as well, but environmental factors and societal factors and things like that play into it too. But we made a conscious effort that we were going to change. One of my, at that time, my wife had recently started following a woman, a doctor. I believe she's on the West Coast of the United States, a Dr. Tanmeet Sethi, who does a lot of gratitude related things. As she has a son who has a very rare medical disorder, and her as a medical doctor, knowing that there's nothing she can do to cure her son of this, and has turned to gratitude as a way for her to make the most out of the time that they have and what they're going through and everything like that. And my wife and I saw that idea and decided to really start making that the way we thought and the way we lived. And so we started instituting daily gratitude practices and things like that. Started thinking about every day, what are we grateful for today? What is the most important thing that we can be grateful for today? And we started looking at what we were going through as an opportunity. We were like, what is the gift in all of this? What can we learn from all of this?
Yeah.
What can we use from our experience now to help others who may experience it down the road?
Yeah.
And so that is the mindset we started to take on as we started doing this. And it really helped shift a lot of things for us. We were still dealing with that fear and the unknown and not knowing what was to come. But at the same time, we were like, okay, well, we can sit here and we can be upset about it and we can let it tear us down, or we can use it to build ourselves up. And that's what we chose to do. And that's how we kind of move forward with it.
That's how you managed. Yeah. So it was kind of like, I'm going to take this problem and make it into a challenge way of thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. A challenge and almost we turned it from being a negative into a positive. We decided, instead of letting this be like a chain around our neck or our ankles or whatever, holding us down, we were going to use it to lift us up. We were going to use it as momentum to keep us moving forward.
Brilliant. So what do you do with your gratitude practice then? So you think of things that, you know, the good things that you've got that you're grateful for. How does that work?
It varies. There's a lot of things that we do. It changes from time to time. In the beginning, we had a practice that we did with our girls because we were trying to help them stay in a more positive frame of mind and not allow things to create a lot of anxiety and things in them around all of this. And even though we were dealing with the unknown, so a lot of times what we would do is we would start our mornings, we would list three things we were grateful for. We would, and it could be anything. It could be, you know, I'm grateful that the sun is out today. You know, I'm grateful that, you know, I'm grateful that I got up an hour earlier than I usually do. I'm grateful for whatever we're eating for breakfast. I'm grateful that we are all here in this moment together. You know, it was whatever you could find to be grateful for. But then we would also go in we would start the day by saying, okay, what are three things that would make today great? And we would think of things that they could be small, tiny little things. They could be big, expansive things. But we found that we were basically creating a more positive mindset going forward into the day, so that when we went into the day, we would be more actively looking for those things that would lift us up rather than something that would hold us back or tear us down or make us feel worse. And we would do that in the morning. And then in the evening, we would say, okay, what are three great things that happened today? And we would look back over our day and find those things that meant a lot to us, that helped make us feel positive and powerful and just strong throughout the day. And then we would also say at least one thing we were grateful for from the day as well. And now over time, it's kind of evolved and changed, but we've also added appreciation into that now. So my wife and I, before we go to bed every night, we look each other in the eye and tell each other one thing we appreciate about the other. Right. Whether it's from this day or from any time in the past or anything like that, it just reminds us that we are grateful for everything that we have and we appreciate what the other does. We're acknowledging how much we do for one another and let each other know that we aren't taking anything for granted.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that, I mean, it's such a great practice, the gratitude and the appreciation. It's something that everybody really should be doing, because you can't be negative if you're being grateful. You can't be negative if you're being appreciative. It does lift your mood, and you're then throughout the day you're thinking of positive things. Rather than looking at what's gone wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things that as I've been going through all of this over the last few years, it was one of those things that really helped deal with when things got really bad. Because when I was diagnosed in 2018 with the POEMS diagnosis, my neurologist also redid that EMG test, where with the nerve conductivity test, and we found out that I had still been able to do most of the things that I had been able to do beforehand, because I do a lot of the cooking and everything at home because I enjoy cooking and whatnot. But when in July we started noticing, like the IgG transfusions that I was getting, would the effectiveness of them, I used to be able to go from month to month and not feel a drain on my energy or anything like that. But as time went on, they started to become less effective until they were barely lasting like 2 or 3 days before that tiredness and that sluggishness came back. And we ended up stopping those after my POEMS diagnosis, because they realized that the reason it was becoming less effective is I had a lesion on my hip, a skeletal lesion in the bone, that was causing abnormal plasma cells to be produced within my own body and my own blood, and it was proliferating throughout my system. And the reason the IgG infusions were no longer working is because my system had been continually building that up more and more and more. Right. And so the abnormal cells now were proliferating throughout my system more so than any transfusion was going to be able to help me with. So
basically fighting against it, was it? The transfusion was going in and your blood cells were just going crazy and producing even faster.
They would just wipe out any benefit that those infusions were having in shorter and shorter periods of time. So I ended up having to go in for radiation therapy. But of course, in order to get there, they had to do a bone marrow biopsy. They had to do multiple biopsies at the lesion site, because it was in bone. They're more difficult to get to, because if you don't get enough of a bone sample from there, the testing procedure can actually destroy the sample that they have before they can get any kind of results. So I had to go through multiple biopsies in order to get that verified. And during that time, during those couple months, as all of these extra testing and things like that were going on, I started to lose the function in my hands. When I got diagnosed with POEMS, one of the reasons why my neurologist then decided to do the EMG test was because he he realized that even though I wasn't noticing a progression, that was the same thing that happened before. There was a very small incremental progression. And when he tested my arm at that point, he noticed that my arm communication with the nerve in the nerves and the muscles was only about at 50% of its normal capacity. It hadn't reached the point where it was physically affecting my hands, although I had been noticing I was dropping things a little more frequently. But then when he did that test and then we started doing more physical testing and things like that, we started to know that we were right at that precipice of the decline. And within a month, I had almost completely lost function in my hands. The muscles in my body started to atrophy rapidly. I lost 25 pounds in the course of a month from just the neuroconductivity stopping communicating in the muscles. And also when we did that EMG, he was testing my legs again and noticing that the nerve conductivity further up beyond my knee, up toward my hip, was starting to increase as well. So we were seeing, even though we hadn't seen the external signs that these things were happening, internally they had been happening for months now. And then once we got the diagnosis, as we were going through all of these testing and everything like that, and then we finally got to the point where everything was clarified in what they were dealing with. And then I went in for 5 weeks of radiation treatments. It was basically radiation every day, 5 days a week for 5 weeks in a row.
And that must have taken a big toll on your system as well.
Yeah, it basically zapped any energy I had. I, at that point, after my POEMS diagnosis, after I got the biopsies and everything like that, my physical health had been deteriorating. Now, we were lucky in that my parents live about an hour away from where Johns Hopkins is in Baltimore. So we went and we would stay with them. We would go down, do whatever testing we needed to do, and then we would come back home. But from July, we went down, and when we came back home to West Virginia, where we waited for the diagnosis to get confirmed. Once it was, I remember it because everything was scheduled, and it was the day of my daughter's birthday.
Oh.
It was her, ninth birthday. Yeah, it was her ninth birthday, our youngest daughter's, Liumbra's ninth birthday. And we had planned a birthday party for her and everything. And we were like, you know what? We're going to do this. And I had to be at Johns Hopkins the next day on the 21st for the bone marrow biopsy and everything. So we were like, you know what? We're going to let her have her party. We're just going to shift it a little bit earlier. We're going to have her birthday party. And then after her birthday, after her party, we packed everything up. We loaded up the car. We drove down to my parents. I got up really early the next day so we could go down to the hospital and get the bone marrow biopsy. But her birthday was the last day I was home for almost 5 months.
Right.
Because after the bone marrow biopsy, I couldn't maneuver stairs anymore. My legs had gotten so weak that I couldn't do that. The testing was coming. I was going and getting multiple tests done a week and everything. And it was just, there was just no way I could travel back and forth and keep up with that pace. So I ended up staying at my parents' place, and they were helping out with ferrying me back and forth to the hospital and everything for all of my testing. And, you know,
and did Danny and the girls move back home during that time then?
They did. They actually, what they would do, we homeschooled. So it made dealing with this a lot easier in some ways. But what would happen is they would, we have a homeschool co-op that they belong to. And that was on Thursdays every week. So they would go there once a week to have classes and stuff like that, they all put together, all the parents and everything took turns teaching different classes, depending on what their backgrounds were and what they, and everything like that. So Danny would spend half the week down in Maryland with me and then the other half of the week back up here. And that was the way they lived for quite a few months, actually. Mm. It was a very kind of strenuous time for them. My parents actually had to help kind of rearrange, because they have a multi-story home. So there were a lot of steps in their home. I ended up living in their basement for those months. Yeah. And because they had a walk out that you could just walk directly outside to. And so everything was able to be on one floor for me. So I just lived in their basement for those 4 months. They moved a bed downstairs down there for me and everything like that. And it was just, we kind of set up a space for me to have there so that I could, just so that we could make things work. And it was difficult. It was hard. But at the same time, we reminded ourselves how grateful we were that my parents could do that for us, that they had the space for us to be able to do that. We were grateful for all the friends and family who helped us out during that time and everything like that. And it was challenging, and it was scary, and it was terrifying at times. And, you know, we had to make a lot of difficult decisions and choices at that time about, you know, what to do if my condition continued to worsen and everything like that. It was one of those things where it's just like, you know, there are conversations, you know, you eventually have to have, but you always think it's something you can put off till down the road. And then this was when we became very acutely aware that, no, this is something we need to discuss now. And while it was hard, we realized that we were able, it allowed us to kind of connect, and it also allowed us to find a peace in that.
Yeah.
That knowing that should it happen, should things happen where if I didn't make it through all of this, that the girls, Danny and the girls, would be taken care of, all of it would be okay, and that they would be okay. Because that was always my concern.
Absolutely.
And
that,
you know, if nothing else, that gave me a sense of peace that no matter what happened, everything on that end would be okay.
Mm-hmm. And so how are you now? What has happened?
Things are getting a lot better. I still go back for testing every 3 to 6 months. They do the blood workup and everything like that. But after the radiation, the progression of the numbness and everything was stopped. And it's been, that was in October of 2018 that I had that. My body has finally now gotten to a point where I can pretty much feel everything again. Functionally, I've been cooking again for about 6 months now. So I've been able to kind of get back to that. In some ways, I've gotten back a lot of my functionality. I still have to wear leg braces for walking and things like that. But it's one of those things where I've completely had to reframe my mindset, because early on, I had a very difficult time with the amount of progress my recovery was making.
Yeah.
And I would get upset that I couldn't do more and things like that. And then I started realizing that I was losing sight of the gifts in all of this. And it reminded me to slow things down. I learned to meditate because of this process, and learn how to make peace with a slower and a more incremental pace. One of the things that I started reminding myself of is that, you know, progress can be measured in millimeters instead of miles. And I always remind myself of this now, especially because, you know, almost 3 years out now, I still don't have full use of my hands. I still don't have full use of my feet, but I'm able to curl my toes just a few millimeters more than I was before. The fact that I can actually move them again is something that my doctors have said that they don't know where my recovery, they don't know if I will make a full recovery or if I will have some impairment. But in my mind, it's just like, you know, I'm always going to keep pushing, going to keep progressing and keep moving in that direction. And I will be grateful for every ounce of progress I make, no matter how small.
Yeah. And as long as you keep moving forward, like you say, even if it's only a millimeter, at least it's forward. Yeah. And all those millimeters add up over time, don't they?
Yeah. Every little bit. And it's one of those things that, you know, and it's taken a lot to have that perspective and keep that perspective, because there are times when you lose sight of it and you have to kind of sit down and take it in. But I mean, you know, in talking about the gifts of all of this situation, no, it's created a situation where I could sit here and talk to you about it. And my neurologist up here, he, after my POEMS diagnosis, I had called him to let him know what the official diagnosis had become and told him about, you know, how they determined that from what he had been doing. And he was able to help one of his other patients while not having to deal with POEMS, had another neurological and actually had an autoimmune disorder that might not have been picked up for a few years of more testing, depending on the line that they went down. But he ended up sending her to get tested for specific things, and they ended up finding out what was wrong with her. But that might not have happened if my situation hadn't happened. So I was grateful for being able to help that person.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's allowed me to really, and it really opened myself up more to personal growth and things like that, because I realized too that I had reached a kind of spiritual and emotional stagnation with things, and that I'm able to now be more open and more less restricted on how I think and approach things. I'm not always approaching it from that scientific point of view, which sometimes can be very limiting because you're just not willing to take that opportunity or that chance. So I've found a lot of things to be grateful for through all of this. And there are times when it's frustrating and it drives me crazy that I still can't quite do the things that I was able to do. But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't trade this moment and this experience for anything, because it's allowed me to become who I am now. And I'm much happier now than I was before.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything we go through is, I think, is here to teach us something. There's a message in everything. Any suffering, we can pick up a message from it, and we can carry that forward and use it to serve others. So what does the future hold for you? Obviously, you're going to focus on getting better every day, and hopefully that will continue. But are you going to use this knowledge in any sort of way, like write a book or?
Well, actually, yeah, that's something that my wife is actually working on a book now. Hers will probably be done before mine. And hers is from the perspective of the caregiver, the person who is taking care of the person going through the illness. Because one of the things we've really learned and come to respect through this whole process is how much it's not just the person going through the illness, but it's the people around them, and it's the people who take care of them, that they are going through their own journey and their own transformation, and they need just as much support as the person going through that illness. And so she's writing her book from that perspective of caring for that caregiver, about the process that she's been going through and she's been dealing with in all of this, in order to be able to better support me while I go through my process. Mm-hmm. And at this, and so I'm hoping to sit down and start writing from my perspective of the person going through the illness, but also just that change in mindset, and also that connectivity between the mind and body, because I've through all of this, I realized how much my thoughts and my own attitude really affects just my physical body. Like I am so in tune with when my mindset starts to slip into negativity, because I can feel it through my body. I can feel it through my nerves and everything like that. It's one of those things. My blood pressure was sky high at one point because I was in that stressed state all the time. And I had to learn to calm myself down in order to allow my body to exit that stress state and heal better. And that's one of those things. And more than once, my neurologist at Johns Hopkins had said to me, you know, he's like, I admire your attitude in dealing with this, because there are things that he has said. He's like, you know, he said, there are things that your body is doing that that scientifically, neurologically, it shouldn't be doing. And he said, your attitude is helping you immensely in that. He's like, I'm not going to say that that is what's allowing you to do it. He's like, but I wouldn't discourage you. I wouldn't tell you to not stay doing that. So, you know, it's kind of that. So yeah, I'm hoping to write a book from that perspective. One thing during my illness, I've always been kind of a writer. I've been writing a long time, mostly fiction and things like that. But early on, before I got my therapist to help me deal with the emotional things going on with this, I was writing a lot to deal with it. And I have a few stories that I'm going back now and starting to edit and kind of refine that I'm hoping to publish, but they're fiction stories, but they very much embody a lot of the emotion and things that I was feeling during that time, and have just, and in order to process it, I translate it into a fictional story. So they're not like happy kind of things. They're dealing with a lot more of the negative things. So they're very dark kind of stories, but at the same time, I'm looking at them and I realize how therapeutic they were for me to be able to at least express what I was dealing with and feeling during those times. And So writing has really been a major component of this and coming out of it. And that's what I'm hoping to move forward with. And then there are a couple other projects that my wife and I are kind of just in the planning stages of that we hope to really kind of move forward with in the next year or two after, once we get the books and everything going and whatnot. And, you know, and doing things like this, coming on the podcast with you, working within the Lifebook community and everything as well, and just trying to help uplift other people and sharing what we're going through as much as we can so that hopefully somebody else can learn from it. So,
yeah. And I think, I mean, many listeners will be not aware of poems at all. I know I wasn't before I met you. So it's really interesting. And you know, if anybody was listening and thinking, well, I've got tingling feelings, I'm going to go and get myself checked out. So, you know, if that was the case and one person got checked out and found out, yeah, I have got this problem or a problem, then that makes a big difference. So
absolutely,
it's absolutely brilliant that you've been on here talking about it today. Do you have any last messages that you'd like to leave listeners with?
I think the biggest thing is that changing your mindset around something that you see as a setback or a negative can really influence how you can thrive from it and how you can rise up above it. You know, there are situations that the negativity will just eat you away and tear you down, and it ends up being more harmful to you than the actual event itself. So if you can just reframe your thoughts, change your mindset, it can make a world of difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. And if somebody wanted to contact you or find out more about poems, where would they look? How would they contact you?
If contacting me is a little difficult because I went on a bit of a social media hiatus. I am on Facebook, but I rarely go on it. I mostly through Messenger. The only social kind of aspect of things right now is Lifebook, which if you're part of that community, you can find me on there. If not, it's a little difficult to find me right now.
if somebody was interested and wanted to know more about this, illness? I think there's plenty of information online anyway, isn't there?
Yeah, the Mayo Clinic actually has a very good breakdown of what POLMS is and everything like that if you want to go on there. And at some point, I will reemerge from all of this into a more social presence, right? But right now, I'm still spending a lot of my time and energy just trying to get myself back.
Absolutely, yeah.
Into You've things got enough and whatnot, to think but, about,
yeah.
Yeah, but my wife is more, Danny's more of the social media presence than I am at this point.
Well, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you today. Thank you so much for coming on and going through this. And I wish you all the best for your recovery. I look forward to all of your books when they do come out, and Danny's as well. It'd be really interesting to read.
So, thank you, Sue.
As I say, thank you so much for coming on today, and I wish you all the best for the future.
My pleasure, and thank you so much. I was very glad to do this.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to today's story. And as always, if you want to ensure you don't miss any future episodes, then please subscribe. And if you yourself have a story to tell, then please do get in touch with me. I'd love to hear from you. And until next week, take care of yourself, stay safe, and I will see you soon. Goodbye.